You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue. 8:56 on the West Coast. 11:56 where both my next guests are at. Joining me to talk about an article that's in the online version of this month's Marine Corps Gazette. No, is it in the online version or is it in the regular version? Go.
Online version.
Online version. Okay. All right. They're both former Marine infantry captains. Both are now no longer in the Marine Corps. Barndoller, and we'll get to the bottom of what that name is all about. But Barndoller, he's aimlessly wandering the country like many guys do when they get out of the military. So he's unemployed and not even looking. So that's interesting. And then on the other end of the spectrum is former Marine infantry captain Sam Long, R. Sam Long, and the R is important in this because he's a Harvard guy. Now, if he was just like a normal human, you wouldn't see R. Sam Long. He'd just be Ricky Long. But he's a Harvard guy, so we've got to have that initial in there. So first of all, boys, thanks for coming on All Marine Radio. I appreciate it.
Hey, happy to be here.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, we need to find out a little bit about both of you. So walk through this with me. So, Gil, born and raised where?
Born up in Vermont in Burlington and then raised in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
All right. And went to college where?
Went to college up in Maine, the Bowdoin Polar Bears.
Oh, my God.
Home of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain.
Yeah. The number two hero at the Little Round Top. Do you know who the savior of Little Round Top was?
You mentioned this on the air before. The
brigade commander.
Senior guy was there first. The brigade commander was there first, right?
Strong Vincent. Yeah.
All
Chamberlain was the rhetoric professor in the rear of the formation. Okay, now I don't want to talk shit about him because he was wounded six times and he's a great American warrior, but who do you put in the rear when you're going to battle in Gettysburg? Your strongest guy or your weakest guy?
Gosh, this is okay. Slander.
I know. I just want
get
you
our
to
our hero slandered.
give it some thought, okay? I'll tell you what, one of the greatest decision making, if you want to read decision making time in combat, in what was one of the, I'll tell you what, maybe one of the biggest tactical decisions that had strategic implications in the Civil War is Strong Vincent's decision to stop a courier, read the message, take his brigade to Little Round Top, because without that, the Union gets their asses kicked on the second day at Gettysburg, and there is no Pickett's charge, and God knows where it goes from there. So, anyway, just a little bit of research. As long as you got all that free time on your hand, come on, man. Not always good to get smarter. And then, Sam, where were you?
Absolutely.
Where were you? First of all, what's R stand for?
It's Robert.
Robert.
Like any good Southerner, my first name.
Really? Well, that's why would you go R on that? Is did you like Sam more? I mean, Robert's a cool name. I thought it was going to be like Rutherford or who is that? I don't know, some other goofy name that you initialed and went to the middle name. So why go to the initial? What's that all about?
I think I don't actually use the initial, although coming out of this place, I probably should start. I think Barndoller actually put that on the article, so I think he's enjoying this probably more than just about anyone right now.
Taking a lot of shots 5 minutes in here.
Look, it's All Marine Radio, man. What did you expect? Joining us today are two authors. That's not the way we do it here. No. Born and raised where, Sam?
Yeah, born and raised in Houston, Texas.
Oh, really? No kidding. Your family's still down there?
They are, yep.
How are they doing? They get through everything, or did they get flooded? Or
Yeah. Everybody in the immediate family is good. They sat and watched the water rise for a couple of days, but ended up being all right. I have lots of childhood friends who lost a lot of possessions, and hopefully a lot of that stuff insurable, but it's definitely a painful time for a lot of people down there.
All right. Well, I mean, I hope you know that everybody's thoughts and prayers are out there. But I'll tell you what, state of Texas has acquitted itself pretty well and all that and reminded Americans what it is to be American in spite of a lot of people that try to divide us. It's pretty cool to see when the shit hits the fan. The state of Texas has been a great example for the whole nation about how to rally around your community, how to rally around each other, regardless of race, creed, color, or income, and do the things that need to be done. So pretty cool to watch that.
Yeah, I thank you for that.
Yeah, no. Where'd you go to college?
Yeah, you're not going to like this, but I'm a boat school guy. So I went to Annapolis in 2005 and graduated 4 years later in 2009.
All right, what do you think of the West Point dude with the Che Guevara t-shirt on? That's pretty cool, huh?
That's probably the opposite of cool, but yeah, there's that. There's the article that the colonel there wrote, and then there's the response by Professor Fleming in the last couple of hours at Annapolis. So there's a lot that the academies have cause for self-reflection on.
And that's, I'll tell you what, and that's been a fight that's been going on for years on those campuses, honestly. And I go back to my conversation with John Allen going to Annapolis to do a decision-making thing in 1990, 1991, and him talking about how his stomach gets in a knot because it could be such a greater organization, but there's forces on the campus that want it to be a liberal arts college. And then there's others that forces that want it to be a military school, and they don't live peacefully together. And so it's been interesting because that whole discussion has been thrown that carcass has been thrown in the middle of the room here recently. So interesting stuff. Maybe we'll have you back and do a little roundtable and talk about that if you don't mind. I'm not a boat school. I'm not an academy hater. I love those places, but I am familiar with the war that goes on that campus for the soul of the campus. And when you have guys like John Allen that are pained that don't even want to go back, that tells you a little bit about how long this has been going on, and how strong the feelings are about that. So anyway, interesting.
And I generally subscribe to the belief that and I did an exchange semester at West Point when I was there, so I got to briefly kind of understand that place a little bit as well. And the potential for greatness is there at both institutions, and I'm sure at the Air Force Academy as well. But I don't think it's a controversial statement to say that both are falling short and painfully so.
Well, you know what, I would tell you. Not to get too philosophical, but I think it's the same issue that the nation confronts itself. We see it in the United States Navy writ large. We see it also in the Marine Corps. Life without standards, will we back off things that have made generation after generation, that has served the nation, gone through the military? Those things are, there's certain things that are hallmark of discipline, of being ready, being prepared, and would you sign up for that? And it seems to be more and more, and maybe this is the lament of the old, that those things are going by the wayside. But it certainly seems to be that, at least to me anyway, interesting topic for discussion in that, are we still willing to pay the price to bear the standard, to meet the challenges of the future? And I think it just seems to be a very, very interesting topic, leadership at all levels in the country, and our desire to do the things that need to be done, to include compromise in the Senate and the House on budgets and get that work done as well. It just doesn't seem like we're capable of shouldering the burdens, the leadership burdens around the nation. I think we do so at the peril of our democracy, maybe not in the physical peril, but certainly the international standing of it. So, anyway, I know you guys are interested in my comments about that. That's why I went long format on that. Let me ask you, how did the Marine Corps get on your horizon?
So it was kind of a weird case. I'd always planned to serve, and had no desire to, fly a plane or drive a boat or whatever. But, my senior year of college, broke my ankle, just dumb drinking thing, fell off a fence. And at the same time, got a scholarship to grad school. So in the meantime, I was doing that for a few years. And then when I came back in and was talking to recruiters, I had a buddy that had gone the Marine OTS route after graduating from college and just, you know, spoke about the caliber of the institution, the guys he worked with. So I went to talk to an OSO, got surgery, and then went from there.
So how did you know that you wanted to be, like, where did that come from? Like, did you have family or
what? No family. Yeah, my only family history is on the, you know, on the wrong side of World War II. My mother's German, so I had, you know, grandfather served on the Eastern Front against the Russians and spent 3 years in Siberia. But, no U.S. family history. My dad's side are diabetics and no real, no history there. Not in recent time. But, yeah, I grew up reading a lot of military history and just being inspired by what guys went through and the, you know, challenges of that life, I guess.
So did your grandfather ever talk about the Eastern Front?
A little bit, occasionally. It was, and I, you know, looking back on it, he's gone now, but it's something I wish I'd spoken to him about.
Oh, my God. Where did he fight?
Yeah. He was captured near Smolensk, I think. He was, you know, I know a few little details.
Holy shit. Those were like the battles of encirclement. There's like 8 million people against 8 million people, and they got it on. It was, I mean, the battles, the scope of the battles on the Eastern Front blow your mind. In fact, I'll tell you, you know, as an American, right, you go through grammar school and whatnot, right? Like World War II starts Pearl Harbor, okay? And then we fight in the Pacific a little bit and then North Africa, and then we do some stuff into Italy and stuff like that. Then we're island hopping through the Pacific. Then we land at Normandy and we defeat the Germans. Okay? Then you start doing like big boy and big girl history and you're like, what do you mean this thing started in, like, 1938, 1939? What? And the Russian front? What is that? Oh, my God. So Normandy was, like, a rear action for the Germans? We didn't defeat them? We didn't? Like, no. That's and it's pretty sobering when you do read about the Eastern Front. And, wow.
Yeah, no question.
And then how long was he in Siberia?
So he was captured in let's see, I want to say late 44, may have been, actually, I think it was probably early 45. And then he didn't come home until, so he's from the southwest, from the Black Forest and the kind of southwest corner of Germany. He didn't get home until 48. So, you know, better part of 4 years. Some guys got back later than that, you know, the ones that survived. So.
Interesting. I interviewed a guy, his grandfather, was Polish, was in the Polish resistance at the age of 16, captured by the Germans at the age of 17, escaped when he was 18, recaptured when he was 19, and because he already had the arm, the number on his arm, they sent him to Auschwitz, and he was a laborer at Auschwitz. And I was like, holy smokes. I said, did you ever sit down and talk to him? He said, you know what? No. He would talk about it on occasion. And, but he went back to Poland and wanted me to go. I was 17 and I had a summer job and I just bought a car and I said I didn't want to go. And I look back on that and I hate myself for not going back with my mom and dad to Poland. And because he went back to Auschwitz, he went to Buchenwald and all the different places. So, wow. Interesting. How about you there, Sam? How did the military, how did the Naval Academy get on your radar as a young guy?
You know, I was a freshman on 9/11 in high school, and it became pretty clear, I think, for anyone who was watching, in sort of 2003, 2004, that things weren't going well, in some of the foreign pursuits that we were engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, I'd always been a reader of military history, and my dad is probably who I have to thank for that. He was kind of shoveling these Stephen Ambrose books before I was even probably literate. And, you know, we watched Band of Brothers together. And so, you know, always go with a healthy respect for those who served. And, you know, I think just wanted to do something different and kind of started to do some of my reading. I read Absolutely American by Lipsky. I would go on to read later, you know, some of the other early junior officer memoirs from the Iraq War Fix book, for example. But also read, you know, Long Gray Line, Fields of Fire and some of the other books from the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, West Point and Annapolis were on my radar.
You bet.
Through the process for those places and ended up at Annapolis and looked around a couple of years in and noticed something different in the Marine officers and senior enlisted that they had at the academy did a little bit of research and digging on what a life in the Marine Corps would be like and pretty quickly decided that I wanted to be a Marine.
All right, so real quick, Gil, through your career, you come on active duty when, and what unit do you go to?
So I came, usual, OCS, OCC, right into TBS, IOC, and then went up to the West Coast at First LAR, went to myself, and we had a big group, like a dozen lieutenants checking in together. So we were all there with the RBE as the battalion was coming back from Afghanistan, so went to LAR Leaders Course, checked into First LAR, got a platoon there, and then deployed with the battalion. We must have left very end of October of 11. So standard platoon commander deployment down there in southern Helmand.
I only missed you by a couple months. I left in September.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, we could. We were almost battle buddies. Damn it. Then you would have got the easy treatment. I would have laid the wood to Sam here. So you do that deployment, and then go from there. You go back home, and then what?
Yeah, so came back pretty quiet deployment down there. I had a phenomenal group of sergeants. Was really lucky. But pretty quiet deployment down in Southern Helmand in the winter of 11 into 12. Came back to Pendleton and, became a company XO, had that for about 6 months, but was kind of jonesing to get out the door again and put my hand up for the first thing I could really get, which was the Georgian liaison team.
Okay. All right. And just so everybody knows, my guests this morning are Gil Barndaller, former captain, United States Marine Corps infantry type, and Sam Long, former captain, United States Naval Academy, United States Marine Corps, and both of them wrote an article entitled Putting the First Team on the Field, Irregular Warfare and Marine Combat Advisors. Talk about your career, Sam. So you did the Georgia rotation, and then when did you get out?
So I came back from, in... I'm finished up here.
Yeah, go ahead, Gil.
Yeah, go back, spring of 14, or winter of 14, was in the battalion for another few months at 3 Alpha, went to back to the East Coast PCS, the 3rd FAST, and did a couple deployments at Gitmo and Persian Gulf, Bahrain deployment out of there, and then EAS at the end of 2016.
Okay, got it. All right, Sam, talk about your career. You get commissioned, when do you go on active duty?
Sure. Yes. So I came in 09, TBS, IOC, and then checked into 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines there at Camp Horno. And checked in with a group of about a dozen lieutenants, similar situation to Gil, trying to just come back from Helmand. Except our group of guys pushed out the following year on the 31st U. So spent the better part of the year between that and some wonky exercise that we did in Korea that took up a couple of months before the deployment. So the better part of 2012 in the Pacific, splitting time between Korea and Okinawa and Australia, the Philippines, and all the Liberty ports and mischief that entails.
Nice.
Couldn't have asked for a better group of lieutenants to serve with and learn from and really cherish that experience and friends with most of those guys to this day. Came back and was just desperate to avoid going back to Okinawa, and so I volunteered for the GLT. About 45 days after getting back from Okinawa, I left 2-1 and checked into the advisor team, which is where I met Gil, did that deployment with him and those Marines, and then I came back. And I knew I was getting to leave the Marine Corps. I had about a year left on my contract and had a conversation with our battalion ops officer that said I could hang around Camp Horno and probably not be a great influence and not really be vested in what I'm doing, or you can cut me loose and I want to go teach advising for a year, because we just came back from this pretty interesting experience of 6 months in Tbilisi and another combat deployment to Afghanistan on the tail end of that. And I learned a lot and made a lot of mistakes. And so if you'll let me go down to Del Mar and teach advising, I think that's the best solution for everybody. And ended up going down there and and running, ended up actually running the advisor training branch during the last 6 months of my time in the fleet, and that was the impetus for the article that Joe and I wrote.
Okay. All right. And then and when did you get off when did you leave the Marine Corps?
I left in early 2015.
Okay. All right. And tell everybody what you're doing now.
I am in my second year at Harvard Business School.
Boom. That's right. All you monkeys out there. All right, let's talk about the article. Where did how do you guys cross paths, and how does this topic come up?
So I think we both checked in the same day. Go ahead, Tim.
No, you go ahead.
All right. We checked in together in January of 2013 to ATC, and had, I think a 3 month workup in the States, then 3 months in Georgia, kind of getting synced up with the battalion we were advising, getting to know everybody, figuring out our roles and training with them. And then a month in Germany for their big certification exercise, their
right.
version of like a Mojave Viper.
Right.
And then deployed to Afghanistan. So we were ourselves and the other guys in that 18-man team were pretty tight, across four different countries, I guess, for the better part of the year. And as we were going through it, we just sometimes, I don't want to say overstated here, but just disappointed by how the Marine Corps tackles advising and has done since September 11th, essentially. And our ROIC would kind of joke around with us. We should put something together and write something. And so over time, as we came back, and especially as Sam got in the saddle at ATC and saw the inside of the beast there, that provided even more kind of impetus and reason to sit down and put something together and try to help improve the process.
All right. Let me ask you, Sam, let me ask you a question. What do you mean? What do you mean how we select, right? Hand selected, right? Uniquely trained, uniquely qualified for those requirements. So are you telling me that's not the way it is?
Yeah, in a nutshell, yes. I think the Marine Corps has advertised to the nation, to Congress, to ourselves, that we've got this unique capability in foreign force advising. And I think for a long time, our history, going into the banana wars and some of the actions in the Caribbean and Central America 60, 70, 80 years ago indicate that we were at one point good at this and better than any other service. I think we still are decent at it, but we could be a lot better. It's almost similar to the conversation we're having about the Naval Academy. And what I saw in practice, and this happened on our team, and I think Gil and I, even though we'd only known each other for a week or two at the outset of our team forming, we were a little bit in shock over just who showed up to join the team. And then, when I got to ATC and I saw the teams being assembled and was responsible for essentially training and equipping the teams, it's a very haphazard process that the Marine Corps goes through to select these advisors. And on the officer side, it involves usually discussions. It's coming from the infantry world, it involves discussions with a battalion XO and a battalion commander, who's got time that can do the deployment, who's in what build of the battalion on the senior enlisted and NCO side. It's, what sergeant is, up for promotion but hasn't deployed recently, who's a cancer in their platoon and should be sent, or who's an all-star and can't be sent who can't be given up for a deployment, and all of these personnel issues that the battalions grapple with to find out who should be tagged for these duties essentially yield, 8 times out of 10 subpar candidates for advising is what I saw. And so just to clarify for those that may not understand exactly how the system works, when a need comes from downrange for an advisor team, that goes to the 1st Marine Division or 2nd Marine Division or 1MEF or 2MEF, and then those billets are essentially like a system of taxation where it says, okay, 2-1, you're going to give up a sergeant, 1-1, you're going to give up a captain, 5th Marines needs to give up a major, and the NCOs are going to come from 1-5. And so then this forces sergeant majors and battalion executive officers to kind of fulfill their taxes by finding the people who can do these deployments. And so it's almost backwards, right? You would think that if you're going to go advise foreign forces, you want to find the Marines who are most physically fit, intellectually prone to working with foreign forces, and will best represent the nation and the Marine Corps abroad. And it's unfortunately not what we found.
All right. Let me ask you both a question. Comment both on this. And Gil, go first. We're not the Green Berets. Okay. And again, I'm just by coincidence, I was a guy who supported a lot of these requirements. So Sam, were you at SOTG?
So when I was there, it was transforming from SOTG to EOTG. So I think it's the same unit that we're talking about, but there was a little bit of a rebranding campaign in 2014.
Right. Okay, so is that where you were?
So when I was there, it was a standalone part of the G7. It was called the Advisor Training Cell, and that's how it had been for, you know, a decade before that. And while I was there, it was administratively folded into EOTG as the advisor branch.
Okay. The I will tell you this. I knew General Tulin from 2004 when he was the RCT1 commander. And I met him in Ramadi, and got to know him, small world kind of shit. He did the change of command with Colonel Nicholson at 8 in the morning. He gets on a flight and he flies to Germany at 4 in the afternoon. Nicholson, there's a rocket that comes through a boarded up window and into Nicholson's office, a 120 millimeter rocket. About 30 seconds before the rocket hits, Nicholson had asked the COMO to send somebody to check his one of his computers because he couldn't log on or something. Nicholson gets out of the seat. The COMO, a major by the name of Shea, sits down. Nicholson's in the corner when the rocket comes through. The rocket kills Shea and severely wounds Nicholson. In fact, something really, when you see it blows you away, but he has, General Nicholson now has the 5th Marine or the 1st Marine Regiment battle colors, with his blood on it that was framed and given to him by the Marines of the regiment. So pretty moving thing when you see it. But anyway, Tulin calls back from Germany and I answer the phone and he says, "Mac, I need to talk to General Mattis." And I said, "One second, sir." And General Mattis had gone to bed, I think, and he was out in his suit, so I go and I wake him up. And I said, "Sir, Colonel Tulin wants to know if he should come back." And he said, "No, tell him to go home." I was like, "Oh, this is going to go over well." And so I go back and I said, "Sir, he said to go home." And he cussed, and then he slammed the phone down. And so when he came over to MHG, and he asked me, he said, "How can I help?" I said, "You need to help SOTG." I said, they get every crazy requirement thrown at them. They're not staffed well enough. They're not equipped well enough to do what they're doing. And they're you know, little Dutch boy sticking their fingers in the dike. And these requirements were coming all the time. And I want to say General Tulin had a meeting at the MEF commander's meeting. He put everybody on blast saying, "We are going to send our guys. This is phase four. This is when we're trying to win this thing now. We're trying to convert this thing now. We need our best guys." And so he sent out, I don't know if you all remember, but he sent out a whole list of, if you have one major in your battalion, you're good to go. If you have one logistician, you're good to go. If you have one either this, or this, you're good to go. And it was all, it all had to do with stripping down and trying to get the best guys to these billets. Sam, do you remember that?
I don't remember that message. I remember that specific message. I remember a lot of rhetoric, you know, ranging from you know, POTUS on downwards about how advising was the main effort in the war, and it was the only way that we would successfully extract ourselves from both conflicts was to create you know, permanent, viable host nation forces.
All right, let's.
I think that's one of the reasons that both Gil and I volunteered for this mission is because you heard the senior leadership talking about how important it is, and
right.
You know, when you're a younger person, you're like, I want to dedicate my time and my effort to something that someone like General Mattis is saying is important. I think I do want to be clear that the Marines that ended up on these teams, to a man, generally did their best. You know, I don't think the system, you know, the blame for the system does not lie with the lieutenants or the sergeants that were chosen. In fact, most of the combat arms Marines that were on these teams were volunteers. And I think generally when you have someone volunteer for something, you're going to have a better personality and skill fit than when you tell someone to do something. And so, it was a lot of the support personnel that ended up, you know, being sent and kind of gave the unit the reputation that you talked about with the stepchildren and the Dutch boy with the thing on the dike. But, you know, Gil and I served with some, especially on the NCO side, some Marines that did a phenomenal job, both in Georgia and then in combat.
I got an email for both you guys. Mac, I've read about the Georgia Rotational Battalion, Brigade, or whatever they used to call it. My question is, would the Georgians fight? I heard good things about them. I've never really had a conversation with anybody who was there with them. Did they do a good job? I think I recall them being in the vicinity of Musekela. Am I right about that? Appreciate the interview. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, that's where we were. We were up in
Gilman. Yes.
Yeah, I'll take that. I guess for starters. Yeah, we were in near Musekela, I guess southern Nauzad, really.
Right.
But I think the Georgian rotations, and you know, from what we saw and talking to our counterparts, when we were over there, there was another Georgian battalion down at Leatherneck doing more of the force pro around there kind of thing. And doing kind of local security down there, and then talking to, you know, predecessors that went over there. I think a lot depends on the personality of the leadership. You know, it's such a, I would say this, that the Georgians, you know, have a small kind of independent nation that has a history going back millennia and one of the first Christian countries and a lot of other stuff. They have, you know, to some extent, a well-developed national pride and even sometimes a chip on their shoulder, and they would, you know, they fought a war with the Russians in 2008. But I will tell you that they do have really still the Red Army in their DNA, and it's a very centralized top-down organization. You know, they can play nice and kind of put the PowerPoints together and talk MDMP and, you know, kind of pair it kind of the way NATO militaries do business. But they ultimately are still a very centralized force. And so the personality of the commander at all levels, both at the company, the battalion, and then up to the national leadership plays a huge role in how aggressive, their battalions are going to be over there.
I've got another email. Sam, did you have any comment? Did you want to make a comment about that?
I think that one of the things that's interesting to think about is, you know, the short answer to that emailer is yes, they can fight and will fight. I think what you have to do is put your, and this is, again, we write about this in the article, why, you know, empathy is a critical skill of advising, but, you know, you put your shoes in the 19-year-old enlistee from a village in the Caucasus, and maybe you're from one of the border regions, you know, on the border with Russia there, and you join the Georgian army. It's like Gil said, they're pretty proud people. Like, that translates to some stubbornness downrange. But your country has just cut a deal with the United States to provide infantry forces to the, you know, to the war on terror and to fight in Afghanistan. You know, it's there's not necessarily the same ownership, you know, involved with making Afghanistan a better place than my Marines, for example. And you know, there wasn't the same tie to the country. Guys that were on their third or fourth deployment to Afghanistan. And so the Georgians could and would fight, but were not necessarily willing in a lot of ways to do things that were going to increase civilian security or some of the themes of counterinsurgency that you hear about were not what they were there to do.
So it was a job and they were trying to stay alive?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
No, I mean, again, I heard, I can't remember if we had Georgians up by the Haditha Dam, but you heard a lot of that in that, hey, their first solution is going to be with that 12.7 machine gun. You come near anywhere near that dam, somebody's going to pay. And then they'll ask questions later. They're not afraid. Collateral damage? What? Bug splat? What? Yeah, that doesn't matter to us. If you get in the way, you get in the way. And our whole notion of collateral damage, civilian casualties, is completely foreign to them. And so it's a pretty interesting cultural phenomenon. I'd be curious, and I've got an email about that. I'll read the email. Mac, I have advised one of the interesting things is to see the world through the lens of another culture. Our American values are so different. Our American way of fighting is so different. In many ways, other countries put their lives at the very front of the line. Everybody else's are far back. They don't mind civilian casualties. They think civilians ought to get out of the way, and if people do stupid things, then they get what they get, and they don't worry about it a whole lot. It was very educational for me, and I didn't look down on it. It's simply the way their culture is, and it's absolutely black and white for them. They look at us and are intrigued and scratch their heads at what we worry about. They see it as war, and in war these things happen. I'd be curious to what your guests have to say. Your thoughts on that, Sam?
Yeah, I'll respond to the piece about looking at the world through someone else's eyes,
right,
and how it relates to advising. And I think Gil's got some probably better comments on the Sidcast piece and on just like what it's like to advise someone who will shoot a civilian if you're and like what the kind of tug is on your role as an advisor. So yeah, I think we talk in the article about how it's hard on American NCOs sometimes to work with foreign forces because we delegate a ton of authority and responsibility to our corporals and sergeants. And my guys would routinely get frustrated because of this phenomenon where, you know, like Jill said, there's still remnants of the Soviet military in the Georgia that's heavily centralized. The battalion commander makes a ton of decisions, and if he's not making the decisions, the company commander, but really, really nobody else. And my counterpart, who is a Georgian captain in his late 30s, was just sometimes just floored by what I let my NCOs do. You know, what do you mean that the corporal has come up with the patrol route for tomorrow? Well, the corporal's got a pretty good sense of what this place looks like and where we should go and who we should talk to. And so navigating that is a key function of advising. But I think, like your emailer said, you cannot do it from a place of arrogance. Cultural relativism is a slippery slope, and if you go too far down that, then you're excusing behavior that is absolutely wrong. But there is a place for understanding that people have different values than you do, and that they're not necessarily wrong. And I think that's what I'm talking about when, if you can't screen for that at the battalion level to see if a Marine is emotionally mature enough to be able to understand that, then that person's not a suitable advisor.
Let me ask you a follow-up on that, Sam. Did most of your guys have previous combat tours? Was that a requirement? Because to me, in my opinion, it ought to be the rare exception that you're going to experiencing these things for the first time and then trying to advise somebody and assist somebody. To me, there's an awful lot to learn about getting shot at, the emotional maturity that comes with the ups and downs of living like that, and then being able to supposedly advise, mentor, and support somebody is certainly different. Your thoughts on all of that? Did you have mostly guys who had been to combat at least once, or did you have a mix?
There's a mixed bag, I'd say, amongst the infantry Marines on the team, and we had both infantry and, you know, our team covered down on the intel and all the warfighting functions, logistics and comm. Amongst the infantry Marines, generally, yes, but for example, you know, on the team that I led that covered down on the Georgian Alpha Company, I was the only guy. That was my first combat deployment, and so the Marines that I led were great about kind of talking about their experiences. At the same time, you know, Fallujah is there are lessons to be learned from being shot at in Fallujah, and I relied on the Marine that I had that had that experience. But it, there's a lot that cannot be transferred to working with the Georgians in Northern Helmet. And so right. I think I would agree with your general thought that the more experienced guys you can get, always the better. But again, that sort of intellectual dexterity about being able to cherry pick which lessons you're going to apply to this new experience.
Exactly. Gil, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I'd echo that. And it was definitely a mixed bag. We had some guys that, you know, deployed tons, obviously the senior staff and CO for the team, and, you know, guys with Purple Hearts and skins on the wall. And then there were other guys who in some cases hadn't deployed at all. You know, we had a couple of second lieutenants who, you know, good dudes. And, you know, there was one of the other company advisors was a second lieutenant, great guy, you know, light years better than I was as a second lieutenant, but first deployment. So there was really a mix, and it kind of spoke to what we talked about earlier in terms of the screening process or the lack thereof with combat advisors.
Another email. Interesting topic today, Mac. Advising is certainly something that we have done for a long time. It seems like the Army is a little bit further down the road. As they do it institutionally, we kind of move in and out of it as advisors. My question is, did either one of your guests watch the Vietnam War, and did they see parallels? Did they see things we could have done better between things that we did in Vietnam and things that we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan? So, first question, did you guys watch that series on PBS?
Yeah, I'm catching up. I'm halfway through, so I think I'm on episode 6 right now. Yeah, I know you've done a lot of stuff on the show about it. I think it is. I think in balance, he's you know, pissed off both sides. So I think he's done a pretty good job of straddling the political divide on Vietnam. But to speak to the advisor issue, and I know there's some folks in there, both Marines and Army, that are brought in that speak in the show about serving as combat advisors with the Vietnamese. Yeah, we try to do, you know, as much research as we could to look at that piece of it. In the article, a couple times we mentioned lessons learned, and there's a good book by the same guy that wrote The Bridge at Dong Ha. He wrote a book called The Covans about Marine advisors,
right,
with the Vietnamese Marine Corps, which is really good. Miller's the guy's name. But yeah, I think one of the biggest takeaways, and it gets discussed, I think you're having Tenkro Lucio on the show. I think you referenced having him back on. But his article in the Gazette, which runs in this issue, and you know,
right,
I don't want to jump too much on that, but he talks about that and the fact that the Marine Advisor Training, the MATA, Marine, or the Military Assistance Training Advisor course they ran down in Fort Bragg, that was mostly run by SF personnel,
right,
but four conventional Army and Marine guys. That seemed, by all accounts, that seemed to turn out a pretty good product. And we don't have anything analogous to that. The Army now, as your emailer said, is standing up permanent Security Force Assistance Brigades, which are going to be these kind of cadre brigades, real staff NCO and officer heavy, essentially no junior soldiers, and those are going to go over and in theory at least take on the whole advising mission. So they're standing up a military advisor training school down at Fort, I think at Bragg or Benning, one of those places, to handle that and to train those guys. And that's all to the good. I would argue, contrary to some folks, that I don't think the Marine Corps has the force structure to stand up permanent advisor units without really cutting into the meat and the bone.
Sam,
that's something I should say.
Yeah, oh, all right.
Yeah, just to sort of finish up, that's something we propose in the article, is that is kind of a middle ground between the ad hoc method of advisor training, which hasn't, to our mind, has not worked real well for the last decade and a half, and then the other extreme is standing up permanent advisor units, and we think the solution's in the middle in terms of training and selecting advisors, putting them back in conventional units to continue to, you know, develop and lead as Marines, and then sending them forward as advisors when the need arises.
All right, let me ask you, so in terms of the conclusion of your article is what?
I think our conclusion is just that we continue to pay lip service to the importance of the advisor mission, but essentially I don't think we're too far, you know, I think a lot has changed since we wrote this article. You know, you've got the advisor training branch under EOTG. You've got the same thing of this globally sourced, you know, pick some guys under, in theory, you know, Dines and squadrons and whoever else are sending their heavy hitters, but whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. But essentially, we're back where we were, and we had these ad hoc teams being sent forward. We argue there needs to be a permanent recognition per DOD doctrine, a recognition per joint doctrine that advising is an enduring and permanent and core competency of all forces, to include Marines, and that it's time we take it seriously by establishing a proper way to select and train Marine advisors.
Sam?
Yeah, I think that's all that is correct. You know, I think, look, the Marine Corps, and I think that's one of the reasons why all of us join the Marine Corps, is because we perceive it to be an organization that is not going to undertake something unless it's going to be done correctly.
Right.
And there's the capability within the Marine Corps to be, you know, the best foreign force advising, the best foreign advising force short of the Green Berets, and potentially even kind of nip at their heels in some areas and some metrics. And so our article basically says, you know, let's not do this if we're not going to do it correctly. And if we want to do it correctly, here's the way forward. And, you know, and that Marines love schools. Marines love going to, you know, mountain warfare school or airborne. People love their tabs and their patches. And so, you know, we think that standing up a formal school that selects and most critically attrites Marines that don't make it through the school is a great way to have a latent capability within the battalions to do this mission. And then when the taxes do come down from the divisions and from the mess, you've got people within the battalion, just like you've got your assault climber, you've got your mountain leader, you know, then you've got your staff sergeant that's qualified to be an advisor. He's got all the qualifications and he's been screened. You've got your captain that's been screened. And that enables us to maintain kind of the expeditionary capability that we promised to the nation, while also being able to do this advisor mission and do it well.
The you know, one of you're talking about a like not a permanent capability, right? A capability that we need to have the structure there for, and be able to blow fluid into it and blow it up, right? And then when the requirement goes away, to be able to contract it, but maintain the structure of it. I would say almost like the wounded warrior regiments. You know, those things are incredibly, they're invaluable during combat. What do you do with the beautiful buildings, the incredible physical therapy facilities? I mean, Olympic level physical therapy facilities and equipment. What do you do with that? Do you shutter it? Well, you can't. So what do you do with it? Well, do we send the sick, lame, and crazy over there, and we use that for them in order to keep the capability resident, so that the next time we need it, we have it. Where do you suggest that this kind of school reside? Who should own it? And do you put people so that it runs classes on an annual basis, and then from that we're able to expand that into something larger as the need requires? Is that how it works?
Yeah, exactly.
We propose.
Go ahead, gentlemen. You got it.
We propose, yeah, a Marine Advisor Training Center that is a permanent approach to this that trains, certifies, trains, and really, like Sam said, selects and attrits Marines for this designation, you know, and then these guys go back to their battalions, continue on with their careers in whatever their field is, whether they're, you know, grunts or logisticians or comm guys or whatever, but they are now kind of a cadre force in waiting for these enduring requirements that we know are going to keep popping up, whether it's a more mundane, you know, 6-month kind of peacetime advisor deployment, or a heavy, you know, national effort level combat advising mission overseas. So as to where it is right now, we said in the article that just drive on with McSig and make McSig the – McSig is down at Fort Story in Virginia, and they are for essentially the center of excellence, if you want to use the Army term, I guess. They are the resident experts on that, but they kind of focus more on TSC than on advising. I know Lieutenant Colonel Lucio proposed moving it to 29 Palms, which probably makes sense, aside from, you know, everybody trekking up 29 Palms. But in terms of facilities and ranges and some of that, that may, if we're going to take it seriously, that may make the most sense. But the advising mission, again, we view it as preparing advisors being as much education as it is training.
Right.
So, I think where you have it is less important than having it and making a commitment to that.
Is the training piece, when you're not actually staffing the mission, is the training piece much less important than the education piece? And then those things would move to, you know, a different ratio when you're actually staffing it? Or is it because I'll leave it at that. Sam, your thoughts on that?
I think, you know, when we joined our team, you know, I think Jill and I were a little bit dismayed to find ourselves 60 days into our workup, you know, doing a CMP shoot and shooting table 3 and table 4. And like, we could all do that. We were coming, Gil was coming from first LAR, I was coming from 2-1. Like, if we couldn't do those things, then, like, why was I wearing a uniform? I remember, you know, to Gil's credit, he assigned the team to read some obscure, like, World War I history of Soviet conscripts and their performance in one of the initial, I guess it was probably in World War II, I guess, is what you pass read Gil. You know, it's basically some account of Soviet conscript performance in battle. And what he was trying to have us do was kind of understand the historical roots and legacy of the Red Army and what we were dealing with from a military culture standpoint.
Right.
And I remember, you know, some of the guys on the team went home and read the whole thing in one night. And then, you know, some of the guys on the team like, couldn't be bothered to read this like textbook that this lieutenant was making them read, or this article that this lieutenant was making them read. And I think those are the things that make you a better advisor. Or getting in a room on a whiteboard and saying, okay, if there's 4 of us on patrol and there's 12 of them and things go really poorly, like, what is the SOP? Because what has to happen? Well, like, we have to report. We also have this, like, 12-man foreign squad that we have to interact with and move out of the kill zone. And so I think training is important. I think one thing that we hone in on the article is combat life saving is something that, you know, that the medical, the field medic or medical skills, those cross the language divide and those build confidence and cohesion in a unit. But a lot of the work of advising is almost like mental work or academic or intellectual work. And if you've selected the right guys, then you don't need to verify that people can shoot from 50 yards with their M4 at night.
Interesting. One more email, then I'll ask you the general question, and I'll let you go.
We should probably get a good Tbilisi Liberty story in at some point, too.
remember, you guys still, I think, are subject to the UCMJ, so be careful. The article is entitled Putting the First Team on the Field, Irregular Warfare and Marine Combat Advisors. I've got an email for you. Mac, what was the one thing that they did before leaving that they would tell everybody, you need to do this? And should we even be in the business? One of my big bitches when I was at Division CP in roughly the same period was, we never said no to any requirement. All we did was we took them and we staffed them and we went to the next one. The Marine Corps has got to get out of the business of saying yes to everything. For the love of God, there is only so much we can do, and it's like the Marine Corps feels that if we don't say yes, at some point we're going to get put out of business. It was stupid. It was absolutely stupid, some of the stuff that we had to staff. And I was very disappointed with the leadership at MEF that they wouldn't push back on this stuff. Because not only did we have these requirements that we looked at very seriously in terms of staffing, but what the hell were we going to do with our own battalions that still had commitments in Westpac? They had to be led as well. And I don't think that MEF did a good job with all of that. In fact, I think they did an absolute poor job. I'd be curious to hear the thoughts of your two guests. I've enjoyed the program this morning. Boys, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, taking those in reverse order, I mean, I think obviously some of you talked about in the show and, you know, it even gets brought up in some of the congressional testimony and people realize, you know, you've had for a long time in the U.S. Armed Forces, I think, across the board, you know, 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag kind of thing, whether it's pre-deployment training, whether it's taskers coming down from on high. I mean, I think, you know, Sam and I and probably every lieutenant of our generation has been in one of those positions where, you know, you got white space and training and, hey, you got to go do a a static display at the boat basin or, you know, or on the bigger picture, hey, you're going to go TAD for 18 months or whatever, everything in between. So no question about that as far as, you know, the military culture aspect in our military of knowing, of having the moral courage to sometimes raise a hand and say, hey, we can't do this without compromising X, Y, and Z. You know, that's obviously way above our heads or anything we dealt with at our level, but that's definitely a, you know, no question that affects every service. Going back to the first question, I think, I'm not sure if I take, if he means what we did before combat that was the most important or the most important thing we did on the advisor workup.
Take it as one broad continuum. If one thing that you thought was integral, absolutely essential that all advisor teams do.
I think the most critical thing is just cohesion. I mean, you know, that's maybe kind of trite and
yeah, it sounds lame. I mean, does that mean cohesion? Sorry about that. I think both
with the advised force. Yeah, just I think as much as possible.
Trying to keep it real, dog. So are you talking about among the advisor team or cohesion between the two?
Both.
Whoever you're advising.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think especially the latter piece. I mean, that's something that I think, you know, was brought home to us early on is that the GLT is kind of a unique animal in that you go over to, it's the only deployment I know of where you have Marines going over to a peacetime environment, going to a foreign country, integrating with a battalion, training with them, having pretty, you know, relatively permissive liberty, you know, in that country and being in European command and all that. And then from there, you go forward into combat with the same group of guys. So it's very different than, than folks jumping in stride and doing a quick rip and suddenly they're in combat with Afghan police or Iraqi army or whoever else.
Right.
So I think we worked on that, and I think we probably could have done a better job of just getting as tight as possible with our Georgian counterparts. You know, we spent some weekends with them. We did some very feast-centric kind of food and drink culture, and we try to take advantage of that. But I think you almost can't overdo that, short of like, you know, catastrophic professional embarrassment, not keeping up with the toast. But I think you really can't overdo that rapport building. We could talk, if we have more time, we could talk about the Georgian wine and the Georgian drinking culture. But I think you can't overdo that, building that rapport, especially.
Hey, how did you two pussies fare and all that? It doesn't sound like y'all did too well. Did you embarrass the nation? Cause those people can drink. Yes.
Yeah, oh yeah. I think I kept my honor clean. I'm not sure Sam could say the same. I've seen the guy lose a fight with a bathroom mirror in a restaurant. There's a Georgian hatchback car somewhere that still has his insides all over the side of it. So I think there were people on the team that fared worse than him. There were some guys in the fetal position after a night out of eating and drinking in the woods. So. Yeah, I think you can't overdo that piece because you're going to spend that rapport, you know, in combat, in operations, when you have to force them to do something or try to leverage them to do something they don't want to do. So you kind of, you know, just like that, I don't know if it came in when you were teaching TBS and IOC, but that kind of well of fortitude metaphor, it's kind of the same thing in terms of a well of rapport and well of bonding with your counterpart that you're going to spend down over time when push comes to shove.
We didn't have that in the old Corps. We didn't have that goddamn well. We just...
Yep, the new hippie thing.
We just won wars, son. My guest, Gil Barndollar, former captain, United States Marine Corps infantry type, and his compatriot, Sam Long. Sam, your thoughts on all that? Something you would say is indispensable, and did you embarrass yourself and the nation while you were drinking with the Georgians?
Wow. I mean, the choices between lying on the radio and defending my honor. This is hard.
You're Harvard. No, you're a Harvard guy. Figure it out.
Yeah, I guess to do the same as Gil, I answered him in reverse. You know, I think for the emailer who is cited his experience at division being frustrated with all the taskers and requirements. You know, I think the fundamental question that the Marine Corps' leader should be asking is, you know, why does the Marine Corps exist, and do we roger up for things that the Army does, and does that make us redundant? Like, we should be deathly afraid if the answer to any of those questions is yes. And so I think we should, as an organization, we should look at doing, you know, challenging expeditionary and national and critical missions and really nothing else. I mean, maybe that makes me a little bit of a radical from a how I view the Marine Corps standpoint, but I think when you start saying yes to everything and you start putting mediocre performances forward, it's only right that policymakers and people in D.C. start asking, well, why do we have this redundant Second Army? And I think we should be afraid of
it. Even though we would prepare you in probably a very mediocre way for an extraordinary task, what we in the Marine Corps know is that because of the human capital that comes through our door that is different, and we all know it, the human capital that walks through the door of the Marine Corps is different. The commercials, the propaganda, it all caters to a different cat. And when you go to war, you're never so appreciative of that culture as when shooting starts and you see how people, Marines, act under fire. It'll take your breath away. It'll make you cry if you're a pussy.
I absolutely agree with that, Mac. I 100% concur. I think the point is,
and then, my point is that institutionally, we'll prepare you in a mediocre fashion, but what the results we'll get from you, because of the human capital piece of it, are going to be outstanding. But it's not, we haven't prepared you institutionally to be outstanding. There's a human element in there. Where you don't have that human element because somebody screws it up, then you truly have a problem. And I guess that is the point of your point. The point of the article is the institutionalization of something that makes us better, that starts us off on a higher plane that we can stand up and keep stood up as we go forward and in and out of these missions. Because to be honest with you, if you look at the way that we prosecuted the campaign, if you will, against the Islamic State, And what it's going to look like going forward in Afghanistan, it is going to look an awful lot like what you guys did with the Georgians. It is going to go there, partner with them, get to know them, supporting arms, mentorship, and all the things that you do as you get ready to go to combat with an organization. That sounds an awful lot like what you guys did, and it looks like the blueprint, at least the Mattis Dunford blueprint, going forward in terms of confronting different, whether they be Islamic radical organizations or other groups where we do not have Americans in the lead. It looks to be the blueprint. And I'd be curious your thoughts about that. You've seen the whole thing going on, and I know it's hard because we're not there and we don't have detailed information, but what you guys did is very, very similar to what's going on with Iraqi forces and now back to Afghanistan to go do that again there.
I've got a friend who's back at Leatherneck after Leatherneck almost ceased to exist, and it's difficult to hear that you've got people who are back doing things that we were doing two years ago, and then we kind of closed up shop and had to go back and reopen shop. I'd say just to finish the loop on the previous thought about, you know, the thing that I think is the most effective for advisors, because we are going to keep doing this, is, you know, I mentioned combat lifesaver, life tissue training. I think is critical for any advisor, and I think Doc, you all made a great point about cohesion. Our boss made an analogy that I thought that really changed the way I viewed advising. He compared rapport, and I didn't realize never really, well, you don't learn about rapport at the infantry officer course or any of the MAGTAF courses, but he compared rapport to the bullets in the chamber of a pistol, of a revolver. And then once you fire one of those bullets, you've only got five left. And then once you fire your second, you've only got four left. So you spend this entire workup for us in Georgia, for other people, maybe it'll be in Syria or at Leatherneck, generating rapport. And if you've got to go drink their moonshine and their cha-cha and vomit to do so, what you're essentially doing is building rapport and saving up your bullets, because in combat you will use those bullets to make someone do something that they don't want to do, whether that's go out in front of a patrol and sleep for an IED, or whether that's, you know, go on a third patrol of the day when they're only two scheduled. So you view this workup as a rapport generating opportunity, because you're going to slowly draw down, and maybe this is the business school creeping in another category, but you're going to slowly, you know, draw down on that reserve of capital over the course of deployment. And if you get to the end of the deployment and you've used all the capital, who cares? If you can bring them all back, it doesn't matter. But you should build it up as quickly and as much of it as possible. And I think that when I heard that analogy from our OIC, it really changed the way I viewed my time in Georgia.
My guests for about five more minutes are the authors of an article in the online version of the Marine Corps Gazette, and they are Gil Barndollar and Sam Long. The article is entitled Putting the First Team on the Field, Irregular Warfare and Marine Combat Advisors. Sam, you want to comment on that?
On which part of that?
On everything Gil just bloviated about.
Other way around.
I'm sorry. Gil, you want to comment on everything, all the articulate points Sam just made?
Yeah,
I'm happy to have a Gil Bob guy who threw up in Georgia, though.
No, that was an awesome justification / rationalization back there. the revolver is probably a cooler metaphor than the well or whatever, but that's all true. And to go back to what you were saying before, I think one of the best interviews you had on Mac was, and one of the things that stuck with me was General Christmas. I don't know, must have been months ago or last year, talking about being, fighting in Hue, and his Marines had never done so much as, 5 minutes of urban training. Nothing. He and his peers had like a 1 hour lecture on Mount at the basic school.
Right.
And they took down Hue. So we can keep doing business as we have as a Marine Corps and rely upon the caliber of the human capital that comes in the door, which you're 100% right. I mean, that's what sets the Marine Corps apart, and that's what we tend to do. We generally, maybe not always, but a lot of time have inferior equipment and often inferior training to what the Army or what other forces have, and we make it work because of the caliber of primarily the 19, 20, 21-year-olds in the ranks. And we can do that, but that's a dangerous game to play.
Let me just tell you, I imagine
how much better we'd be if we also trained right.
I call it, you're faking it when you're doing that. We didn't set you up for it. You're faking it. And some guys fake it better than others. If you send somebody out there that doesn't know how to fake it very good, then you're screwed. But I guess my point, and what I find interesting, I played General Dunford's comments to the Association of the United States Army convention yesterday. And Dunford said, I made two assumptions coming into this job 4 years ago. One, was it 4 or 2 years ago, whatever it was. One, that the operational tempo would slow down. It's kind of funny in retrospect to hear this. The operational tempo would slow down. Two, that sequestration would be dealt with and the budget issue would be resolved. He said both of those assumptions were invalid. He said, now as I look forward, what do I see? We have Iran that we deal with. We have Russia that we're beginning to deal with. And I asked my combatant commanders, for instance, in Europe, what phase are they in and what phase are we in? Well, they're in phase two. What phase are we in? We're in phase zero. How does that work? Not going to work. If they're in phase two, we better be in phase two. And so advising is going to be going forward. And just think around the world. You have, events relative to China that are taking place in the Western Pacific. You have North Korea. You have Iran. You have what goes on in Afghanistan. You have what goes on in Iraq and Syria. You have what goes on in the Horn of Africa and that region. And then you have what goes on in Eastern Europe. All of that simultaneously going on. And so advising has to be, because, we don't have the troop formations to go do that. Advising is going to have to be, an important component of what the Marine Corps is going to embrace, because it's going to have to be the way we do it. And so his comments were very interesting, and I'm very curious. I've got another email. Just a quick, ask them what they think about MCSCG. So first of all, MCSCG, what is that?
That's MCSIG, the Marine Corps Security Cooperation Group, and that's effectively the advising hub right now. You got the ATGs, I think they're called, at EOTG now, like we talked about when they got folded in, as Sam was wrapping up shop and actually kind of doing that process in 2014, 2015.
Okay.
But, McSig down in Virginia Beach, and we did a month of training there. We did their foreign advisor certification in 2013. McSig, you know, I think it is, they have, unlike a lot of places, they have people there that have been combat advisors, the folks that were teaching our classes. Some of them had, you know, invaluable experience fresh off the battlefield and were great instructors. But when we went through the course, and again, this is 2013, but I don't know how much has really changed over there. It was kind of a hodgepodge of different stuff to get this 1 month kind of foreign advisor gold certificate, they called it. You know, you had live tissue training, which Sam said was invaluable and, you know, can't say that was the most important hard skills thing we got.
Right.
You know, you had a very basic foreign weapons live fire. We ended up shooting a weapon the Georgians don't even use. You know, the Israeli Galil, which they pretty much phased out. So that was kind of, you know, half and half. And then you get this, we got some Georgian language training, and we got the chaotical kind of cultural,
right,
you know, cultural training, which went hand in hand with language. So there were some good things about McSig. I think the Marine Corps needs to have a place that is the hub for advising, and that's the natural home for it. And there is some resident knowledge there, I think, and commitment to combat advising. It could probably be in a better place, like we said, 29 Palms or somewhere else. But it's more that McSig needs to kind of look at itself, I think, as being primarily about combat advising versus theater cooperation, you know, and those are not the same animal. And you can put both under one roof, but there's a clear division between the two things. So I would say it's a mixed bag, I guess, to sum up.
Got it. All right. First of all, I just want to thank both of you for coming on doing this today. Very, very interesting, very, very timely, I might add. And just so everybody knows, the article is entitled Putting the First Team on the Field, Irregular Warfare and Marine Combat Advisors. The authors are two Marine captains, infantry type, Gil Barndollar and Sam Long. So you guys don't mind if in the future, if we roundtable this, you guys come back on and talk about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate the opportunity.
Right. Yeah. Would love to and have very much enjoyed today.
Okay. All right. First of all, Sam, it was a pleasure meeting you, and thank you for coming on and doing this, and all the best of luck in spite of all the grief I've given you about going to Harvard. All the best of luck and make us proud there.
Thank you, Mac. Appreciate it.
All right. Not a problem. And Gil, thanks for, first of all, thanks for always being a supporter of All Marine Radio over the course of the last, 16, 18 months or so. I've appreciated your input. I've resented your criticism and disregarded most of it, but thank you very much for always contributing. I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Mac. I think, you know, you're doing the Lord's work with the show, really.
All right. Now, let me tell you can tell it's not very difficult, but thanks. Thanks for the visit today. Have a great day.
Yeah, same to you. Thanks.
There you have it. From the East Coast, advising. You know, the guys who did advising, to me, that's a special group, man. You go off and put your life in the hands of another military, and, you know, and that's not an easy thing to do. And I used to look at them, and I used to think, God bless them, man. I don't know that I would have the guts to do that. I mean, it's tremendously comforting when you're around Marines all the time. It is. It's home. But I know guys who went off and were advisors, and they absolutely loved the experience, and they absolutely loved the soldiers from other countries that they worked with, and were tremendously loyal, and which is very similar to the experience that guys I know who were advisors in Vietnam told the same type of story, and have remained faithful to those Vietnamese soldiers, and have remained active in their lives, active in programs to benefit their children. That story is a pretty incredible story, Marine advisors and what they've done subsequent to that. I want to say, I need to get Ray Smith on the radio show, and because they've, through low 50 years, they've remained involved. And from sponsoring people, bringing them to the country, raising money for kids to go to college, all kinds of different incredible things, that bond of combat forged in Vietnam. That'll do it. The show, I didn't mean for the show to go by that fast, but that's it. This show repeats itself momentarily. So if you missed it, what you'll hear is you'll hear me check out the news. So you got that in store for you. You'll hear Phil Smith, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, prior enlisted, talking about hazing and being a Yankee woodcutter. We didn't get to any resolution on hazing, so we're still struggling with that. How do you institutionally deal with it? Because the model now is we give class, they yawn. Why? I'm writing this. They yawn. We lecture. They yawn. We warn. They yawn. We go home. They haze. We come back. We write charge sheets. We court-martial. And so it goes. That's how it goes. So, unless something has to break that cycle, or else that's how we deal with it. We accept it as part of the Marine Corps, and we hold them individually responsible. But the chain of command isn't responsible, and that saying everything your unit does and fails to do, just a saying, doesn't really apply. Here's an email. Mac, would officers have that same comment placed in their fitness reports? Yeah, absolutely. So it happens to you as a lieutenant. It happens to you as a captain. Might somebody sit down with you and say, hey, can you at least, hey, explain this to me, what happened? Oh, sir, it was one incident. You know, but it's a mandatory comment. Okay, got it, thanks. Second time? Same thing. Single incident. Here's what I think about hazing. Here's what I do. So it's a present event that you have to deal with. And so maybe so you're looking for a mechanism to get people off their ass and get them involved in it. So anyway, all right, that'll do it. 12 minutes over. So my thanks to Phil Smith for coming on, talking about hazing, although we have no solution. And then, I'll tell you what, the last hour has been fascinating. And I would have to agree, you know, the requirements that used to come out of the MEF G3, honestly, I mean, the worst job in that period of time when we began to draw down and then we began to ramp up advisors was in the MEF G1. It was awful. I mean, you have this slate of people, and then there's another slate behind that, and another slate behind that, and oh yeah, yes to UDP, yes to the Muse. Like, who's going to do all this shit? So, and again, that goes back to the Marine Corps. And we don't say no, and that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing. So, anyway, all right. Have a great afternoon. On Wednesday, baseball starts in 3 hours and 46 minutes. Yankees, Houston. Go Yanks, baby. That's right. Fired up about it, too. Got to take my daughter to the airport. Are you kidding me? Like, who would do this to their father? Uber? Hello? Yeah, ain't happening. All right, I'm a good dad, too. Have a great afternoon. This program repeats itself right now. So sit back, relax. If you missed the first part, just relax. It's coming at you.